during the show. And just got to get one or two things quick set up here.
Well, I wanted to thank you for running the hearing and the Bill Moyers speech. I think that's a good public service that not every station would necessarily partake in.
Well, let me get your reaction to the... You were up there at the conference where Moyers made that speech.
Yes, St. Louis.
And that was the last month, I believe?
That was in May.
May. And also your reaction here to these hearings and what was said there, and I guess your reaction to Tomlinson. We're kind of getting toward kind of looking at the state of PBS and what's going on there, and maybe in the larger sense, news in general. But just give me your initial reactions to that.
I think it's important before I say anything else regarding the issues, mainly the funding issues regarding public broadcasting, is that I believe the whole argument is really designed to try to derail a fundamental reform of the system, which is so necessary, as we've seen in the poor performance of mainstream media and public broadcasting in recent years. So I want to make sure that that's sort of our starting point, and that we aren't simply defending public broadcasting or being defensive about it, that there's a proactive position that I think it's easy to get lost in this type of debate.
Well, I guess what we should probably look at, I mean, just having we were talking a little bit while we were airing these, when you were in the studio before we went on air, a lot of this, even if they approve the funding for public broadcasting, just the fact that these hearings and this controversy get brought up is going to have a chilling effect.
Certainly. They've scared everyone in public TV and public radio quite successfully over the last couple months, yes.
And that's, I mean, now is still on the air, but Bill Moyers is not.
Yes, that's true. Although Mr. Tomlinson said he had nothing to do with that, and he wanted to make that very clear.
And Moyers said that some of the chiefs said, you know, they had to get rid of the Moyers problem.
The Moyers problem, yeah.
During his speech, he relayed to. What's your thought on? I mean, they're calling this bias. What do you think that is the state of bias? And I think we should not just look at PBS news programming and NPR and stuff like that, but in the larger context, I guess. Give us a comparison of what is the state of news, both in PBS specifically, but then in general, and where have we come from? I guess where I'm kind of leading here is that, you know, I remember as a kid there was a time when Walter Cronkite was on the news, and he would say that's the way it is, and that's the way it is, and then people would have a debate about policy. But everybody agreed on the facts. Whereas
More or less, yeah.
Yeah, whereas now if you listen to Democracy Now!, which we air here, or you listen to Fox, or you listen to CNN, or you listen to Now!, you're going to get four different perspectives, and nobody will agree on the facts. I guess, give me your thoughts
on that. That's a very sad, low point that our culture has arrived at, is what that tells me. That if there can't even be agreement on a certain set of basic facts, then clearly what's going on is a quite blatant attempt to control communication and really thinking, practically.
And who's trying to control it? I mean, well, clearly, many would say that you know, Fox News is the PR firm for the Bush administration. But beyond that, whose interests are being served?
Well, we should back up a little bit and just say that all of these outlets, these broadcast outlets are being given a public resource for free, and in return they're supposed to act in the public interest. And a journalist, regardless of what their outlet is, broadcast or not, is also supposed to do that. It's like a Hippocratic oath for a doctor. Well, a journalist is supposed to act in the public interest. Well, what we're finding is that mainstream journalists have been losing that battle pretty consistently lately, and the public broadcasters likewise are very weakened and very fearful of speaking out or providing actual information, the kind of information that the other side will simply totally disagree with and deny, disregard, or just say that's not true.
And, well, it's the media's job to be critical of power.
Correct.
I would think. And as it happens, the Republicans control the presidency and the Congress. Is that seen as bias? Is it bias to be critical of those in power? And if those in power are all Republicans, could that be seen as liberal
bias? See, this word
bias,
I think, is such a... we were talking about this briefly earlier, that it's just possibly the most loaded word in the English language. Bias in what way? Well, it depends on how you view things as to what you mean by bias. But I think what we need to make clear to journalists and public broadcasters and our elected representatives is that what the kind of bias that we really need is a bias in favor of regular people, a bias that's in favor, in fact, of people who may not have much of a voice. Those are the kind of biases that I think are good biases.
Well, that brings me to your Chicago Media Action study. They did a study, or you folks did a study, mm-hmm. of WTDW in Chicago Tonight, which is their flagship locally produced news show. What were the results of that study? And it came out, 10 months ago, I think?
Mm-hmm.
And have you gotten any response from the study? Is it changed things at all? What's going on with that?
Well, it's yes and no. There's been some personnel changes, which I think we may have had something to do with. It's obviously pretty difficult to make a cause and effect relationship that's real direct, but the study came out, and then about 7 or 8 months later, the number two at WTTW left, and then soon after that, the executive producer of Chicago Tonight left, and now the host, Bob Surratt, was given a very short-term contract, so he may well be on the way out as well. So, you know, maybe this was something they all planned to go anyway. We don't know, but the timing's interesting.
What did the survey basically look at and see? What would give us the results of what the survey said?
Well, one of the most important things that we found, and the study was, most of the study was actually done by a Chicago Media Action member, James Owens. I'd say he put in a lion's share of work on this. It was a group effort, though. I would say that the most important fact that we turned up was that, for the most part, the guests that are on Chicago Tonight are virtually the same guests that appear on other mainstream non-public outlets, and that they're representing similar viewpoints, and that those viewpoints are predominantly government and business-oriented viewpoints, and that the public and community groups and labor groups and such organizations get very little air on that show.
Now, you might not have done the same kind of detailed study, but anecdotally, do you see that nationally with public broadcasting as well?
Well, the sad part is that we were really hoping that because we were doing a local study that our numbers would come out a little better than, say, if we were studying McNeil Lehrer, which is balanced to the point of making me ill most of the time. It's way, way too balanced. I'd say, unfortunately, the numbers came out very similar to that kind of a program. And we thought that might be true, but we needed to do the study. And at this point, I can barely watch either one of those programs unless I'm doing some kind of research, or, you know, I have to, like, once in a while watch them. But this is often by accident. I might be thumbing through and I'll see something, but I just don't think that we're getting the kind of public service that we need to, especially today.
Well, and one of the big issues, there was a study done, since we're talking about studies and trends, there was a study that was quoted in a documentary called Independent Media in a Time of War, which was
Amy Goodman.
Amy Goodman's production, which said that in the run-up to the war in Iraq, there were, they looked at all the different kind of talking heads and experts that were brought on, most of whom were military experts, and I don't remember the exact number on the military side, but it was in the hundreds of military experts and kind of voices more or less for or, you know, war. And on the peace side of things, there were three. And this was CBS, McNeil, Lehrer, NewsHour, I think, and two of the other big networks. I don't remember if it was ABC, CBS, or I think it was CBS and either NBC or ABC. I don't remember exactly. So I guess the question becomes, if that's the case locally at WTTW, and that's the case, and we could say, you know, there are different issues, obviously, that are talked about on public radio and public television, but if that's the case in the mainstream media, that's the case on public television, where else do we get our information in some way that, that's going to be...
WZRD.
And we appreciate our listeners. And yes, listen to Democracy Now! And Free Speech Radio News.
When are they on?
Thanks for the shameless plug. Democracy Now! Monday through Friday from 7 to 8 a.m. and then again from 8 to 9 a.m. and Free Speech Radio at 4 o'clock Monday through Friday. But everybody doesn't get us. There is a whole issue about low power FM stations, but that's a little off the topic. But there is low power FM that's coming. There's more of it that's trying to emerge.
Mm-hmm. It appears as if the path is being opened for more low power radio. Yes,
but I guess the question is, we certainly here at WZRD don't drive the public debate very much. I don't think. I mean,
it'd be nice if you did, but you're right.
I was at a demonstration in 2003 where some 800 people were arrested, and I was right behind a guy from the Chicago Tribune who's a reporter, and things were getting a little ugly right before the mass arrests happened, and he went up to the police lines and said, "I'm with the Chicago Tribune. I'd like to leave now." And they said, "Where's your press pass?" And there's a whole thing. He didn't have a press pass because the city and the Society of Professional Journalists were fighting because the city wanted a background check all the journalists in the city. And so,
oh yeah,
there weren't
background
any press passes.
Check for journalists,
right?
From
so
the city, yes.
There weren't any press passes being issued to new reporters. So he said, "I don't have one, but here's my work ID for the Tribune." And they went, "Okay, you can leave." And I walked up right behind him, and I said, "I'm with WZRD. I'd like to leave now." And they went, "Who? What? No." So, you know, if
well, you
the
should
Chicago,
take pride in that.
If the Chicago Tribune runs something on the front page, or CNN says it, it has an impact. Even if Democracy Now! Says it, you know, there are some reports that, you know, in press conferences, there have been some reports, but... Basically, if the New York Times says something, it affects the public discourse. If the bloggers and WZRD and all of us little ones say something, it doesn't have the same kind of impact.
Well, this is all an interrelated kind of a setup. And you are correct. ZRD can't have the influence of the New York Times. It's just not possible in the real world. That's why we need to really change the playing field. There's something fundamentally wrong. And I think one way that can be accomplished is by making a substantial improvement in the funding and the structure for public TV and radio, because they can serve as a model for the commercial broadcasters, the fully commercial broadcasters. The mainstream broadcasters would have an example that could be held up to them and say, "Look, this actually is journalism. Can you try to do it more like this? And maybe the whole picture will start improving."
Well, let's talk about funding for a minute, because obviously this whole hearing that we just aired was about the the funding of public broadcasting. And one of the woman who was in charge of PBS, I think.
Pat Mitchell.
Used to be a Republican. What would she? She was.
You're talking about Harrison.
Harris, yeah.
She used to be a co-chair of the Democratic National Committee. The Republican National Committee, and helped Bush get elected. And so now she's, strangely.
And then beyond, so we have that
CPB.
Influence at the top of the CBB and public, of public broadcasting. And then. The other thing is that we have more and more commercials on public broadcasting, which didn't used to be the case. And Walmart, we were talking a little bit before the show, was a big example of that during the debates about Walmart coming into Chicago. And ultimately, one Walmart was approved. There were two that were proposed. One was approved and one was not. They're all over WBEZ. They were, you know, they were underwriting WTTW programming. How does that affect the coverage that the news department's going to give it? And how has that changed since days of old?
Well, yeah, that's what we need to go back to, is explain what things used to be like, because there's probably a fair number of people listening to this that aren't aware that there was a point in time when public TV and public radio did not air any advertisements for profit concerns, and this was a very strict rule in
Sesame
the early
Street
years.
Could only be brought to you by the letter A.
Yeah, and not Sugar Smacks or whatever, which is unfortunately now the case. That, in fact, should be a big clue to people that do remember what this setup used to be like. When public television and when Sesame Street first started, if you had told people back in 1969 that, you know, yeah, there's going to be ads at the beginning and the end of this otherwise very good children's program, they would have laughed at you. This would have been, that's impossible. You know, no way are we going to end up like that. Well, it's here, it's happened, and now you have to do something about it.
And there's a kind of gray area in there where,
of course, yes,
you have things like the Ford Foundation, which is the Ford Motor Company, but
their
foundation,
yeah,
like the Carnegie Foundation, you know, would underwrite programs.
Well, yeah, they helped get the system started. Both of those foundations were very key to early funding for PBS.
So if you've got the Ford Foundation, that's not quite advertising for Ford.
Depends on what they say. If they say,
right,
you know, this brought to you by Grant from the Ford Foundation, and Ford makes great cars, buy one. Yeah.
So you go from that to now you have just outright ads. Just outright, just like you'd see on 2, 5, or 7 here in Chicago.
Yeah, things that you may have seen on those other channels, yes.
And how does that affect the public? How does that affect the debate? And how does that affect coverage?
I think it can affect in a couple of ways. I think one way, with certain exception, is that it might cause you to not want to do a story critical of that particular funder, or to raise too many questions, or to truly, you know, do something in depth that might raise questions and might cause them to change their funding of your outlet. And I think probably more often it's a more subtle effect, where it's more like a mindset or just a sort of a way of going about doing your business as a journalist or a non-air programmer. You may be doing things that you're not even conscious of, just through force of habit from not wanting to rock the boat too much. Not, you know, this commercialism sets artificial limits on a lot of debate.
So, using that loaded word again, a bias.
Yes.
Bias is not necessarily what's said, but sometimes what's not said, or stories that aren't covered, or stories that are what the managing editor and the news editor, it's not necessarily what the individual reporter covers, but the assignments that get given out, the priorities.
Assignment, the voices that end up actually getting air, you know, these things are all variable if there are unnecessary influences on that could affect content.
Talking about going back, I guess, to bloggers and kind of the future. There's the podcasting, there's the blogs, there's all that kind of stuff. What do you see as the future of that and the impact that that's going to have? You know, I mean, on the one hand, the bloggers are making some indent and some making some noise that's getting noticed. But on the other hand, it's kind of like, you know, if a tree falls in the forest and CNN doesn't know about it, does it matter?
Well, we talked about this when we were speaking about WZRD. As good as it is, that the effect, the influence that it could have is only up to a certain point. You have to know that the blogger exists and what their address is for their website in order to find out about what they're saying. And so unless that person happens to have a national news outlet that can tout them and tell you, go to www.joesmithsblog, it's, you know, going to be kind of hard to find, probably. So these larger, more concentrated mega corporations are going to retain this control that they have for the most part into the foreseeable future. I don't see a major shift. I'm not one of those people that believes that the internet is going to solve all of the world's problems, for instance. I just don't believe that's possible. In fact, the biggest problem right now facing the internet is who's going to control it, who's going to be owning it, and are they going to have control over content?
There'll be some financial issue, some financial thing that'll get in there. And
so we have to constantly be on alert for these kind of overt and covert takeovers of what's supposed to be for us.
Now, what's Chicago Media Action doing these days specifically? What do you folks have on your agenda
just last night, with regard
to PBS and then also just in other issues?
Well, that's a two-parter. Just last night we had a public forum on Iran, had four very good writers talking about, you know, what's the U.S. doing or going to do or about to do to Iran? And
it's the big debate. Is it Iran or Syria?
Yeah, right. It's like, and we all, I think, learned something from that. And a number of people came. And I think it was successful. Cliff Kelly tends to be our regular host for these public events. It was very successful. Now, in terms of public broadcasting, Chicago Media Action, which you can find at www.chicagomediaaction.org, we're active in a number of fronts regarding public broadcasting. Where do I begin? We want one of the things we've been trying to get accomplished is we want Democracy Now! On WBEZ, and actually we would like that on one of the public TV stations in Chicago. It is, after all, a TV and a radio program. I know Bill Moyers in a recent interview called for that very thing to happen, that we should all be, as someone asked him, I think
he
it was Amy Goodman.
He mentioned
been.
That in the speech.
Okay, in the
well.
Speech, yeah. And he says that we should all be pestering our local outlets, and, you know, maybe then ZRD could have that hour or two freed up and get some more alternative programming in there and bump this high-quality program up where it belongs, which is available to everybody.
Now, if you're on the south side or if you're not able to get us and you're in your car and you're hearing this right now, you can go to democracynow.org or pacifica.org. This seems to be the shameless plug section.
That's okay.
You can, of course, listen to Democracy Now! Here at ZRD, as we said, Monday through Friday, 7 to 8, and then again 8 to 9. But you can also get it on the internet. And I know that Free Speech Radio News is setting up a podcast. So there's a lot of ways to hear it.
Why?
But, yeah, I mean, BEZ, clearly, they have the mega reach across. And speaking as somebody from ZRD, and I'm just speaking for myself, I wouldn't mind if Democracy Now! Went up to the next level and went to a bigger station than us. I mean, I think we do good things here, but we can't reach, we barely reach downtown. We don't reach the south side. And even sometimes on the north side, it's a weak signal just because we're a little 100-watt station.
I'll tell you, another fan of Democracy Now, not to beat on that one alone, and I've got plenty of other things to talk about, but another fan of Democracy Now contacted us, wanted to talk to somebody from Chicago Media Action about something, and ended up being Studs Terkel. And the first question out of his mouth was, can you get Democracy Now on? And so there's two people. I think we all probably know who they are.
If you don't know who Studs Terkel is,
you're in trouble.
He's just like a writer emeritus for Chicago. Yeah. I mean, the guy is he in his 80s or
I think he's in his 90s now.
But he's been around forever. It would be my dream to get him on the show one time. But if you get a chance to read or hear anything by Studs Terkel, he's a brilliant old guy. And I met him actually once when I was about 10 at a my mom was working for an alderman who was running against the old man Daily Machine, and he was around at one of the victory parties or something. We digress.
He'd be someone wonderful to talk to about what journalism was and what it's supposed to be.
Right. And
in terms of other things that we're doing here with Chicago Media Action, you mentioned that we did do a rather in-depth study of Chicago Tonight. One part of that study also included a very detailed study of all of the trustees. I think there's 54 of them or something. They have a gigantic board filled with almost entirely by very rich people with many corporate connections. It's a very interesting section of the study to take a look at if you go to our website for Chicago Media Action.
And of course, those people on those boards, and you typically, and I don't know, you get people like I'm pulling these names as people who are generally trustees on big things like this, the Art Institute and stuff like that. You get the, you know, Marshall Fields, you get the...
Oh, yeah, these are the big names, the families, the old-time families, right.
The Blairs, you know, I know those three are connected with the Art Institute. I don't know if they're connected with public broadcasting.
An amazing
at all,
number of investment bankers specifically tend to be gravitate towards these.
So if these people are in charge of the boards, and the boards ultimately have sway over even the CEOs of these.
They hire and fire the CEO.
So the culture that they participate in, they're kind of... I mean, we all have kind of cultural kind of givens that, you know, people in the labor movement have certain cultural givens that, you know, they'll all, basic assumptions are pretty much the same across the board. And I would think the other world, you have certain...
the alternate universe.
You know.
For the most part, with a couple exceptions.
The Barrington set, you know, you've got certain cultural givens that are sometimes similar. I'm not going to say they're all different, but this isn't reflective the greater diversity.
And it makes it that much more difficult to impossible to attain the goals that the system originally set for itself, which is to provide alternative viewpoints and to provide programming for children and minorities.
Have you tried to affect who's on the board? Or I think I remembered something about Chicago Media Action trying to get on the board or something like
that. Be very difficult for any of us to get on the board. It's conceivable at some point in the future that could happen. I think what we really want is the ability. We want a rather drastic restructuring, really. I'm not sure. A lot of stations have different bylaws and means for governance and methods and electoral mechanisms and such. But the way BEZ and WTTW are set up right now is they're what are called, they follow the self-perpetuating model, which means once you're in, and as long as you are going along with what the others are doing, pretty much, you'll stay on that board if you want to, and there's no member elections. This may be Something a lot of people don't know, but if you remember, if you give your $35 or whatever dollars and you get your little membership card or whatever it is you get, maybe people that aren't members think, well, that also gives you the right to vote and pick who the board of directors is. But no, no, no. That
it,
is
it
not
gives
the
you
case.
The right to listen and get it maybe gives you a the, tote bag.
It gives you the right. right to get a premium or to go two for a price of one somewhere. And so, you know, and they say that the people vote with their dollars. They always use that during the pledge drives, that people are voting with their dollars. And I think what they're really doing is, well, this is an election with only one candidate. So.
Well, and I mean, I would say, you know, voting with your dollars, if you, on the one hand, you know, if I choose to, as a for instance, and this is just a personal, again, anecdotal thing, but my long-distance carrier is something called Working Assets,
mm-hmm.
which is the kind of Ben and Jerry's of the phone company. They
right.
they support progressive causes and yeah. give a certain amount of their income to cause left-wing causes and stuff like that. So I'm voting with my dollars saying that I want to have them as my phone carrier rather than SBC. So,
okay,
yeah.
so you're making a selection.
Right, and if you're contributing to... be it WBEZ or, you know, WLUW also does pledge drives. We don't because we're funded by the university, but there you're voting with your dollars to support their programming. But there's a difference between that kind of voting with your dollars and actually having the ability to affect policy.
Exactly. I think the key word would be a direct input. Into decision making or selection of a board members, yeah.
And is there any in public television? Given that they are publicly funded,
mm-hmm.
in large part, not completely, obviously, but in large part from federal funds and from
is there accountability?
Yeah, is there accountability?
Is there any
structure for that?
Basically, no. It's one of the most unaccountable systems you can imagine, even compared to similar systems in Europe and other parts of the world. It's very difficult to get a full financial statement, for instance, especially from PBS. The national institutions guard a lot of their paperwork.
Do they? Aren't they? If they're getting federal funds, are they bound by the same Freedom of Information Act requests?
Well,
that,
they're bound by many of them, but they don't have special provisions that reinforce those kind of ideas, you know, within their governance and in their bylaws. So they make you feel like they're going way out of their way and doing you a favor if you get something like that. And it really is a lot of it's up to the individual institution, so what you'll get. There's only one public TV station in the U.S. that has an elected board. That's in San Francisco. The others don't. And therefore, the people that are picking those boards are the people on those boards. And... there should be one outlet where the public can have a direct say in what happens. I think if we don't change this basic terrain feature of our media system in the U.S., if there isn't going to be one outlet, we're really going to be in big trouble because I think, as a lot of people have learned, an out-of-control media is basically like... a bonfire soaked in gas and you're holding the match.
Well, getting to this idea we were talking about earlier about democratization of the media, let me ask if there's a problem with that. And what I'm kind of looking at is, you know, ratings are, you know, in a way a big democratizing force within media. You know, if something's popular, if more people are watching it, then you go with that. But the impact that's had, at least in my view, is that things like the Michael Jackson trial get covered incessantly because it's a soap opera, Lacey Peterson, or any of those, even going back to the Clinton thing, those are soap operas, those are dramatic, those are pretty people, this girl in Aruba, you know, and I'm not saying don't cover them. I'm just saying...
proportion.
Like with the Michael Jackson trial
yeah.
or the Lacey Peterson trial. cover it. Let me know who got charged, but I don't need to see, like with the Michael Jackson, you know, when you can just tell me charges were filed. You don't need to send a press gaggle to the place and watch them physically stamp the paperwork to file the charges. You don't need Larry King for the hour analyzing every single motion, whereas other stories get buried, like Aristide in Haiti.
Exactly. And this is a question that goes again to your point of what this is a relatively, and I'm guarding my words, relatively new development, at least in the to the extreme that things now such as those kind of stories are taken. The public 30, 40 years ago simply would not have put up with it, wouldn't have viewed these things in nearly the numbers. But because of the great, because of a combination of factors, including a concentration of ownership and the great dumbing down of the audiences.
And the fact that news departments now have to show a profit. That wasn't always the case.
They're not independent. They're all just a small part of a giant corporation that's purely looking at a bottom line. That old, you know, Edward R. Murrow, Tiffany Network kind of outlook. Just you're not finding that now. You get a squeamish 60 Minutes type program retracting statements and going getting paranoid and not doing its job.
What? Talk to us about the history, I guess, of the broadcast news departments of old. And how they were different.
Well, I would have to say that the main thing that distinguishes them is that they were not considered, they were considered separately as a separate entity, and that they still had some strong vestiges of public interest and public service in their missions, and that these were, at least the attempt was made every day to try to function in that mode. And even, you know, I tend to be a kind of a person who says maybe there never really was an actual golden age. I think maybe there's always been advertiser pressures, there's always been corporate pressures and career pressures, but I just think they weren't nearly as pronounced, and I think that's because of a lot of it has to do with the what's called deregulation, which is really just favorable regulation for very large companies.
Well, and the other thing that that's missing that we might want to just touch on is what was called the Fairness Doctrine, which was done away with in the 80s.
There's still a tiny sliver of the Fairness Doctrine that is technically on the books, but for practical purposes, yeah.
And what was the Fairness Doctrine and what was its demise?
You could have a good debate on both sides of this issue, actually, which is interesting because it's about fairness in debates, but basically, there are a couple of schools on this, and I still have not even completely made up my mind on it. I think in theory, it'd be wonderful to have a fairness doctrine. I wonder, along with some people that I respect that have more knowledge on this than I, that it may be impossible to quantify viewpoints, and therefore you could get so tied up with trying to develop a system of, you know, what is one point of view and what are the other points of view? Is there only one other point of view? And how much time was actually devoted to that point of view on where? So it's very hard to calculate.
We've got a call. I'm going to see if this is a caller for the show. WZRD, do you want to talk about this on the air? WZRD, yes. This Tom, I'm in an interview right now. Do you want to go on the air with Tom? This is Tom. Let me call you back later. Okay, well, that was some station business that we'll let wait. Anyway, Fairness Doctrine. Okay.
Yeah, so, but we need something that takes care of those issues somehow. If it's the Fairness Doctrine, fine. If it's holding commercial broadcasters more their feet more to the fire on news and providing more children's programs or whatever it may be, I think all of these things are good. I just have always question the practical workability in some cases of the fairness doctrine.
Well, I guess part of that question would be, you know, if you're having a debate between kind of corporatized Democrats and corporatized Republicans.
What's point of view is, where's the debate?
Everybody's still corporatized, you know?
Right, but you've got this great chart that explains, you know, how much time each side got. So we were fair. So, yeah, it is a tricky thing. It'd be great if, you know, I think, I tend to think, I guess sort of in the ACLU vein, that rather than questioning a particular form or viewpoint of type of speech, just the more space there is, the more public space that's created, if we can have more low power stations, if the internet keeps growing, if there can be any number of other alternatives as technology develops, then I think those are probably the best ways of trying to introduce more debate and more civic discussion and culture.
Okay. Is there anything else you wanted to cover before we wrap things up?
Let's see. Well, if you would like Chicago Media Action's twice monthly mailings, we put out a monthly newsletter, and sometimes there's another action there in a given month. You should send an email to cma@chicagomediaaction.org, and our website is chicagomediaaction.org. And to please follow what we're doing and pester people in power to change things so that we can have an actual media system.
Oh, I'm still in the middle of this. Okay, hold on. Okay. Well, thanks very much for joining us. Also,
thank you.
In about 15 minutes, we're going to have Free Speech Radio News, so you want to stick around for that. That is a worker-run collective of news gatherers from across the world, actually. We here at ZRD have submitted the occasional report to them as well. And as we said, Democracy Now, Monday through Friday, 7 to 8, and then 8 to 9. So it's been Scott Sanders from Chicago Media Action joining us. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
And we're going to do some music. And as I said, in about 15 minutes, we got Free Speech Radio News. This is The Talk.